Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Joining us today is my good friend Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analyses. He's also affiliated with the Center for a New American Security and the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Sam's one of the world's leading experts on Russia, the Russian military, as well as unmanned systems. And it's always a pleasure having him on the show. Sam, thanks so very much for joining us on what has become a weekly update on the Russo-Ukrainian war.
Glad to be back.
Indeed, a pleasure. And our coverage of strategy and conversations with leading national security thinkers is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late, great Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. This strategy series is not affiliated with the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation. Sam, thanks very much for joining us. You've been joining us on a weekly basis with updates on the unmanned war, and the Ukrainians have steadily been building their deep strike capabilities. And this week, this last week was a bit of a watershed. Tell the audience some of the things the Ukrainians have been doing to really try to turn the tables on the Russians, the introduction of new systems that they've highlighted, and then actually increasingly using these systems, as you said last week, to strike up to 800 miles into Russia. Walk us through what we've seen over the past week that you think really is game changing.
Well, back in late 2022, Ukraine said that they were developing a number of long range drones that can range up to 1,000 kilometers inside the country. And then in May of 2023, we saw Ukraine actually hit Moscow and actually hit Kremlin. But striking civilian targets, hitting Moscow, wasn't really as effective as probably Ukraine had hoped, because Russian society was resigned to the war. And even strikes against civilian targets or civilian buildings or even downtown Moscow really were not having any specific discernible effect. Therefore, Ukraine switched its strategy in attacking Russian defense infrastructure and its economic infrastructure, and especially the economic lifelines, such as oil refineries, many of which are located just within several hundred kilometers from the Ukrainian border. Ukraine has manufactured several long-range kamikaze, or one-way drones, as they're called now, OWA, and they have had a very significant effect, because they place most of Russia's European territory west of the Ural Mountains and to the borders of Ukraine, Belarus, and Baltics within Ukrainian reach. And so recently, Ukraine struck Russia's oil refineries, has done so very effectively to the point where it actually affected the larger global energy markets. And Ukraine finally delivered its coup d'etat. It actually hit very deep inside Russian territory, well east of Moscow, into the Kazan region, where the Alabuga manufacturing enterprise is located that assembles the feared Gerany or Shahed drones. So Ukraine was able to strike almost 1,200 kilometers inside Russia with its one-way attack drones. And of course, this raised a lot of questions for the Russians, and especially about the quality of their air defenses and really about the future of a lot of its infrastructure. It appears that the Russian government has no actual plan to protect all the key facilities from such attacks. In fact, a lot of private sector enterprises, including oil and energy companies in Russia, are advised to invest their own money in building up air defense and possibly buying electronic warfare defenses. It kind of shows that this type of strategy can be effective if Ukraine concentrates on attacking Russian defense infrastructure. So the strike on Alabuga may have had a limited effect, but again, it demonstrated that Ukrainians can now reach deep inside Russia and cover most of Russian key territory, where a lot of defense, industrial, and economic activity is located.
Isn't it kind of an outrageous statement for Russian leaders to make? And if you're the Russian public, what signal does it send to you when the state says, "Yeah, this really isn't my problem. I'm not really in the business of defending the country, but hey, you should invest in anti-drone systems." I mean, isn't that kind of insane? And how is that message being received by the Russian blogosphere?
Yeah, it probably doesn't go over very well. I mean, people are very muted in their responses right now, simply because they've learned that if they criticize the government too much, you know, they can be encouraged to commit suicide, or they can be jailed, or they can be killed, or any of the above. And so the criticism is muted simply because the blogosphere cannot really say what it wants to say, so it has to be quite circumvent. But occasionally there are statements like, seriously, WTF. And some of them are actually saying, look, the defense of the hinterland is the job of the military, it's the job of the interior ministry. The right. cost of defending against these threats cannot be placed on the private sector enterprises that rely on the state. So there's probably a lot of very uncomfortable discussions taking place within the Ministry of Defense, Ministry of the Interior, within the Air Defense Forces, and other forces which are tasked with protecting the country. This has demonstrated that no air defense is absolute, right? There's no such thing as an iron dome, no pun intended, on the Israeli system. But right. What I'm trying to say is there's no such system that can cover the entirety of a territory and not let anything in or out. That just doesn't happen.
I think you also got 10 points for the phrase encourage you to commit suicide, which is not funny. And yet, unfortunately, that's the choice that that several, unfortunately, have been forced into. How are these strikes, though, Sam, right? Impressive as they are. And I'm going to get into the industrial capacity, Ukraine's industrial capacity in a second. But how meaningful an impact are they having on the war? Are they disrupting war production? And one of the concerns the Ukrainians have is the pressure they're going to be subjected to by Western governments who want to make sure that the flow of oil, right, and oil markets remain liquid. We've seen that there was a lot of cooperation between Poland and Ukraine, for example, and a bunch of countries on the eastern flank of the alliance. And then, you know, have protested Ukrainian grain entering their territory. Their farmers have taken to the streets, and all the governments capitulated, including Warsaw. Walk us through what meaningful impact there's been on Russia's war fighting capacity through these strikes.
Well, you've outlined a very significant and very thorny dilemma, right? How can Ukrainians actually affect Russian economy, Russian defense industry, which are very intertwined? How can they affect the state's ability to earn a currency for its war prosecution without actually affecting the global domains and the global commons? And of course, that's a dilemma. I think Ukraine only started to really affect Russian defense industry. The strike on Alabuga, the strike and mysterious fires at several key Russian defense enterprises are a new phenomenon. If Ukraine starts sending its one-way attack drones against key Russian defense and industrial facility, which are located west of the Ural Mountains, it can probably achieve a significant effect. If Ukraine starts attacking major infrastructure arteries and railroad arteries, which are responsible for delivering supplies to the Russian forces in Ukraine, that can have an effect. But these are fairly recent phenomena, and it's unclear how the West and the larger world will perceive Ukrainians' continued attacks on the Russian oil infrastructure, for example. But again, there's been a discernible effect because it did shake the global energy markets. So it is not exactly clear how Ukraine can go after Russia's vulnerabilities, right, without the world actually breathing down its neck. But again, its policies of going after key Russian defense infrastructure are relatively new. And I think a lot of defense enterprises should be very concerned in Russia. A lot of significant places that build something or deliver something for the military, and if they're located just several hundred kilometers from Ukrainian border, they should be concerned as well, because the recent attacks have demonstrated that while Russian air defenses can be effective in many ways, it cannot be effective in other ways.
And just before we go to Ukraine's industrial capacity, so you have every expectation that the Ukrainians are going to be mounting many more of these kind of deep strikes against oil, energy, as well as war production over the days, weeks, and coming months?
Well, likely more against the defense enterprises and some industrial facility, probably less against energy facilities. And again, the point is to go after Russia's ability to manufacture weapons and systems. And that's where going after these defense enterprises goes. And so Ukraine has demonstrated it has the weapons, it has the systems, and it has the will.
And talk to us a little bit about the industrial infrastructure, right? Ukraine has been working pretty methodically. I mean, I have to say, probably over for more than a decade, certainly since 2014, and certainly redoubling efforts since 2022. What's Ukraine's ability to actually produce systems like this and produce them in as much volume, Sam, as is necessary to be able to really impact Russia and its war-making abilities?
Well, Ukraine has definitely demonstrated and probably surprised many around the world that it has the capacity to do so. Whether the volumes are present is a big the big question. So late last year, Ukrainian president announced a very significant acquisition of drones, right? We talked about this before. Zelensky talked about at least a million FPV drones, 10,000 other drones for combat and intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, and 1,000 long-range kamikaze drones. And so the will is there, and the capability probably is there, but now the question is whether Ukraine can scale up these successes. Ukraine has probably about a dozen different types of one-way attack drones that have hit Russia at this point that can fly very, very far. And some of these can be scaled up rather easily. Others are more sophisticated. So the question for Ukraine is what kind of types and what kind of models it's going to select out of all of the long-range drones that have attacked Russia until now, and which ones are going to be actually scaled for mass production, maybe not in the thousands, but at least in the hundreds, that can really kind of have an effect on the Russian defense industry.
And what are, right, I mean, what are the categories that the Ukrainians have built and demonstrated competence in? And what are some of the next generation systems, right? Because the Ukrainians have steadily shown that they're able to climb the ladder of capability and deliver ever more capable systems.
Well, the latest achievement is an actual refit of a light passenger aircraft, the A-22. And that's the drone that actually struck Alabuga, which is 1,200 kilometers from the Ukrainian border. So Ukraine has a number of turboprop and jet-powered one-way attack drones. Again, they exist in small numbers. Some even exist possibly as just single models at this point. But there are also other long-range attack drones, which are literally just a pipe with a motor and wings. And there are several of those that have crashed deep inside Russia, representing a very kind of baseline for a one-way kamikaze drone that can fly the distance. All of this is possible by the fact that a lot of technologies needed to build such one-way attack drones are mostly commercial, and they exist in the commercial marketplaces, right? Ukraine started its attacks, long-range attacks against Russia, and especially forces in Crimea, with using the Chinese-made Mujin delivery drone, the Mujin 5 or Mugin 5, however we pronounce it. That drone can fly several hundred kilometers, and it costs, I think, less than $20,000 each. So there are systems, entire systems, that Ukraine can purchase and utilize and has done so. Ukraine has inherited one of the largest defense industrial complexes after the fall of the Soviet Union. So there's a lot of experience in building aircraft. There's a lot of engineering. There's a lot of STEM education that Ukraine is drawing upon. There's a lot of very smart and tech-savvy young people, a lot of good world-class ICT professionals. So all of these people, all of that talent, the old talent, the new talent, all of that came together and has demonstrated to the world that a country as determined as Ukraine can actually manufacture a very powerful weapon that can fly a very significant distance and take advantage of ineptitude in the Russian military and especially in its air defense forces.
And when you say the A-22, you mean the Aeroproct A-22, the two-seat high-wing tricycle landing gear light aircraft. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's basically, it looks a lot like similar Cessna models.
Like a Cessna, like a Cessna 150 class kind of aircraft, which is Ukrainian design and dates, I think, from the mid-90s.
Right.
When we're looking at this long range, war, right? And you've noted this before. None of these systems are autonomous, are they? They're fully right. There's a man in the loop on all of the systems that the Ukrainians are using at this point.
Mostly, yes. And then there are hints that some of these drones actually utilize machine vision, which is basically terrain recognition and object recognition, where the drones can fly along preloaded maps and preloaded routes and don't have to depend on satellites or a connection with the operator. And I believe there were hints that the attack on Alabaga were made possible with such machine vision applications. Such claims are very difficult to prove. Obviously, we're not in Ukraine, you and I. And so we have to take some of that reporting at face value. But this is the direction. This is what everyone is working towards. By everyone, I mean Ukrainian military, the Russian military, the Western militaries, the United States, China, and everybody else who is concerned about modern war. So it is entirely possible that some of these drones can now feature more advanced applications. But for now, these are not fully autonomous drones. They fly along preloaded routes, and many of them actually are steered by operators and satellite links.
Let me go to the Russians. The Russians will study almost anything they get their hands on. Sometimes they're better than others. They made the jet power version of the Iranian propeller-driven Shahed, right? I mean, that was a step ahead. How are the Russians improving their game? And talk to us a little bit about also whether or not the hypersonic capabilities they're using today is really hypersonic, not hypersonic, right? There's a little bit of a debate about that. But first, take us to the unmanned stuff, and then let's get to the Russian hypersonic capabilities.
Right. Russia's go-to drone is still the Gerayn 2, which is a variant of Shahed 136 provided by Iran. It's becoming more and more of a sort of a Russian domestic drone. There's a lot of components that are manufactured in Russia that go into the manufacturing of this drone. There's different coating, there's different engines. And so by and by, it's becoming a domestic drone that is loosely based on the initial Iranian design. And they're still effective in the sense that they can still stress Ukrainian air defenses. They can cause damage if they can get through. There aren't that many jet-powered Gerayn drones quite yet. A lot of them are still sort of turboprop with a very loud engine. The flying mopeds, as they were nicknamed, but they're still dangerous. And with Russia intending to manufacture many, many thousands of these drones, they can cause a lot of problems for the Ukrainian air defenses.
And let me take you to the hypersonic capability. The Russians are always talking about it, whether it's Kinzhal or Zircon. And there have been some strikes recently on Ukrainian infrastructure where the Russians obviously have been trying to make a point by using these systems. Bring us up to speed on the capabilities the Russians are using, whether they're really hypersonic or not, and whether or not they're having a meaningful impact on the battlefield.
Well, let's start with the last question. The impact is rather limited. Russia doesn't have a lot of these systems. There were indications that maybe one or two such launches actually were in fact of something that resembled a hypersonic weapon, but this is still a relatively new and unproven and untested weapon, even in Russia, right? Russian president boasted about this development back in 2018. It took several years to do so. Unclear to what extent he was able to modernize and invest a lot of resources in this very complicated weapon with all the resources going to the war in Ukraine. A lot sort of remains to be seen, and there's a lot of questions about the efficacy of this weapon. It is a powerful threat that could be made against other countries, simply because hypersonic weapons are designed to be intercontinental in nature. But again, Russia doesn't have a lot of them, and there are questions about their efficacy as of now.
Let me take you to the air defense part of the equation. The Ukrainians, you know, and you mentioned last week, right? I mean, the Russians will copy any good idea. Ukrainians have 2,000 gun trucks, for lack of a better word, that range around the country to shoot down things like, you know, unmanned systems, slower flying airplanes, unmanned strike systems like Shahed, in order to be able to preserve some of its air and missile defense missiles, which are expensive and frankly, stocks are running low. What's the air and missile defense side of this equation? Are the Ukrainians still defeating Because, I mean, we have a tendency of forgetting about this, but every other day there is a big wave of attacks that takes place all over Ukraine as the Russians continue to try to plunge as many people in darkness or kill them if they can. So even if it's not primarily in the headlines, it doesn't mean that it's not happening. How are the Ukrainians doing on the air defense side, and are they running short on the kind of weapons they need to protect themselves? And if they're running short of Western systems, are they developing their own systems that can help them? Walk us through what this equation looks like.
Well, for most part, Ukrainians are very successful. They use the technologies available to them. They use their native ingenuity to come up with different counter-UAS and counter-UAV tactics, different types of acoustic electronic sensors to listen for drones, and obviously different types of ways and means to shoot down these drones. Essentially going back to the World War II method of mounting large caliber machine guns on trucks, right? These type of weapons were defending London against German missiles and aircraft. And again, 80 years later, here we are, simply because it's a very effective method and the aerial threat really hasn't changed, whether it's a drone or an aircraft. So Ukraine has a lot of different tactics. In fact, Russians are copying those tactics. They just recently announced in the Izvestia media publication that they're actually basically doing the same as Ukraine. They're going to use different types of trucks and vehicles with different types of machine guns and anti-aircraft guns mounted on them and so on and so forth. So Ukraine has been effective. A lot of Shaheds and missiles are, in fact, shut down. But it is very taxing. And after such a long time, it's probably going to have an effect. Ukraine is constantly in a state of alert. It constantly has to watch the skies. It constantly has to utilize resources, multiple types of resources, to shoot down drones and missiles. But again, they are proving effective. So effective that, in fact, they're copied by their adversary. And no doubt other countries are probably looking at what Ukraine is doing.
Ukraine has been very good at figuring out how to integrate, right? I mean, every once in a while, Washington would say, well, you know, it's too complicated. And we, you know, and the Ukrainians are like, look, just give us whatever you're going to give us and we'll make it all work, right? Don't worry about the integration of that capability. And it's successfully doing so, whether it's with European systems, it has former Soviet bloc systems, right? I mean, they use plenty of 152 millimeter, 122 millimeter artillery, you know, and while also making good use of very modern precision Western artillery. There, you know, NATO has proposed $100 billion, right, five-year fund, $20 billion a year. Washington is debating a very big arms package. From your standpoint, what are the priority bits of equipment that the Ukrainians most need now, both on defense, but also to beef up their offense?
I think the requirements have not really changed. The Ukrainians need counter-UAV, counter-UAS, and air defense systems, electronic warfare systems, artillery shells. They are still talking about advanced aircraft. They're talking about UAVs. And so that package, again, has been articulated earlier, and I don't think those requirements have changed that much.
I'm always trying to see whether or not anything else, Sam, needs to be creeping up, creeping onto that list. From your standpoint, are the lines changing at all? Right. I mean, I'm always attuned to Russian rhetoric, right? And Russian rhetoric is almost always more muscular than maybe reality would suggest. Any movement at all on the line, or despite all the odds, are the Ukrainians still doing okay?
The movement is rather small scale, but it is happening. Russians are slowly creeping up on the Ukrainian positions. They're slowly but surely advancing westward. We're talking about very incremental movements, but Ukraine now has to prioritize where it has to shift its defenders, where it has to shift its weapons and systems. Again, the front line remains more or less static, but there are some pockets where Russians are slowly advancing.
And one last question. You know, before the Ukrainian counteroffensive, we basically knew where they were going to advance. At this point, we know the Russians are preparing for their counteroffensive. Do we know where the Russians are going to be focusing most of the, I mean, first of all, are they building up, right? I mean, do we see clear instances where they're building up capabilities for their own offensive? And where are they going to be focusing their offensive? Do we know yet what the Russian priorities are going to be?
Well, I think the Russians are going to concentrate at Ukrainian weak points. They're going to use their revitalized forces and increasing amount of manpower to continue to press Ukrainians. It will depend again on the quality and the type of weapons that the Russians are going to field and in what quantities and where at the front. But some patterns are going to remain true. They will rely on increasing amount of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance drones. They will rely on loitering munitions like Landsats and Gerinds. They will also rely on a growing number of FPV drones and other short-range combat drones in tactical situations. I think the question here is how much Russians can take. And I think the last 2 years have proven that they can actually take a lot and continue fighting. And
But
so,
are there specific spots that they're going to be focused on, right? I mean, for example, they put a lot of focus on Avdiivka, managed to get it, but at an incredible cost, right? 16,000 or so lost. Do we know yet what are some of the specific spots that we can expect the Russians to be pushing, really pushing hard on? And do we have an idea when the Russians will be, putting forward kind of a big offensive?
Well, it's not clear to me when exactly, but probably by the summer, since we're practically in the middle of April and soon we'll be basically in May. So summer's just around the corner. The weather will improve and the ability to fight will probably be facilitated by much, much better weather than right now. So that's when we can probably expect Russian advances. And again, they'll probably do it around areas where they were able to advance before, such as Avdiivka. Such as in eastern Ukraine. And again, this will all be coupled with the tactics that Russians have used before, such as a combination of air force as well as unmanned systems.
And one last question. Any sign that Putin is moving toward a wider mobilization, or is he holding off at this point?
Well, they're not actually talking about a countrywide mobilization, but they are now talking about this conflict as a war. So the Russian president and the presidential spokesman use the word war instead of just a special military operation. So the context for this conflict is widening, and we can possibly expect some level of mobilization to take place, again, assuming that the Russian president needs that. For now, of course, there are plenty of volunteers that have signed up. There are other forces which could be cycled through so that the Russian president can avoid a very unpopular word, mobilization.
Last question. Janet Yellen was just in Beijing and basically was warning the Chinese against helping the Russians. Is that having a meaningful impact at all in China's help for Russia?
Well, that's unclear. Obviously, there's been some new revelations about what China is doing, what kind of intelligence it's providing to Russian forces, what kind of weapons and systems it's providing. China views its relationship with Russia as very pivotal against its perceived pressure from the United States. But again, China is very much plugged into the global trade and depends on trade with the United States. So China is in a dilemma, and it's unclear exactly how far it's willing to go right now.
Sam, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks so much for joining us. Have a great week and look forward to having you back on again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Vago.
A quick word from our sponsors before we go. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, HII, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Thanks very much again for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.